Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Million Shadows by Jancy Patterson, narrated by Savannah Gilmore. 1. Wearing Tommy Amato's pants was an exercise in self-restraint. As I sauntered down the street toward Tommy's girlfriend's house, all I wanted to do was hitch them up on my hips so they wouldn't feel like they were about to fall to my knees. But Tommy never did that, even when his belt was clinging to the lower half of his boxers by static alone. So I swaggered like Tommy. My bones thickened to nearly double their normal size. Every muscle packed with extra bulk, which I supposed was to be expected when a 16-year-old girl spent her morning in the shape of a large 30-something-year-old man. The pants weren't literally Tommy's. They were his favorite brand and color, and I bought them at a thrift store so they wouldn't look new, since none of Tommy's pants were. But the most important and most difficult piece of my cover wasn't the pants. It was Tommy's truck, which I could see parked on the curb up the block. Producing a truck identical to Tommy's would have taken me a month. The model was rare. The nearest one I could find for sale in the same color was in Fresno, nearly a 6-hour drive away. And even that one wouldn't be perfect. Tommy's driver's side fender had rust spots in a pattern that resembled moldy cheese. His mermaid hood ornament was a collectible that sold for hundreds on eBay. And worst of all, the back bumper was hung with truck nuts so greasy I wouldn't have touched them with 2-foot tongs. I really didn't want to fathom how I would go about making my own. Lucky for me, I didn't have to. My current resources were too scant to make what I could easily steal. I continued to saunter up the block toward the truck. The curtains to Tommy's girlfriend's house were all drawn, and I hoped that, inside, Tommy was still fast asleep. It wasn't unlikely, given the amount of alcohol I'd watched him down the night before. I tailed him to his girlfriend's house, which made it easier to break into his empty place and steal his spare truck key. Then again, the guy was so hammered that I probably could have walked right in his front door while he was home and taken the thing. I could have stolen his truck right then and there, if that's what I needed. But Tommy's truck wasn't the goal. It was just a piece of the persona, like the wide shoulders, the thick hips, the shaved head, and the peeling scalp that made Tommy look like an oversized onion. Even the cash drop was only half of the real take, though I fully intended to steal that from Tommy's underdealer, who worked behind the counter at Tommy's convenience store, hawking cigarettes and overpriced snacks. My mom and I needed cash to stay on the run. The people who were after us were too dangerous and knew our old habits too well. We couldn't chance accessing any of our old accounts unless we absolutely had to. It was far safer to live like all we had was what we could acquire now. Though, at the moment, I was the only one doing the acquiring. Tommy's girlfriend's house remained quiet as I approached, unlocked the driver's side door, and climbed in. Tommy might call in the theft of his truck before I finished the job, but I didn't think he would. There were too many Graham bottles in the glove compartment. This, Tommy would want to take care of himself, and by the time he did, I'd be long gone. I started the truck and drove down the street. Driving to the job decked out in my Tommy persona, I could almost pretend I was in the middle of the kind of mission I used to run. The sort that involved data theft and high-profile clients and a team to watch my back. The old me would have been disgusted to see what I was doing now. I used to be a spy. Now, I was nothing more than a thief. I told my boyfriend 2 months ago that I wanted to get out of the larceny business, and yet here I was. Because that was before. And here in the after, I do whatever I could to help my mother survive. When I drove up to Tommy's convenience store, I pulled into the parking lot by barreling over the low curb without slowing down. The truck nearly bounced me out of my seat, since I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. It was a stupid thing to do, but it was the same thing I'd watched Tommy do every morning for a week. So it was also part of my cover. Though I charged into the parking lot like the place was on fire, I slouched into the store like I had all day. That was the one and only thing I liked about Tommy, that contradiction. I shoved the glass double doors open wide and ambled into the store. I walked right up to the counter, past the cases of smoking apparatuses with their unlikely label, for tobacco use only. Tommy's drug dealing operation was so thinly veiled it was a wonder they didn't get raided twice a week. It was all I could do to restrain myself from calling in a tip. but I couldn't get extracurricular until the job was done. Before the doors even closed behind me, I fixed my eyes on Angel, the greasy hair cashier, who was wearing a tight shirt and baggy cargo pants. I didn't know what was with Tommy's operation and pants that were decades out of fashion, but I was pretty sure it had something to do with the ease of hiding stashes of drugs underneath the folds of clothing.
Hey, man,
Angel said. I grunted in return. Tommy was a man of few words. I knew this exchange because I'd hung out in the snack aisles yesterday and memorized every word. I watched Angel's posture as he bent over the safe, pulling out last night's register haul. Obviously, nothing about my appearance had led him to believe that I wasn't Tommy, nor should it. I'd done my research, and I was good at this. Angel withdrew a clear pouch from the safe, full of cash, and offered it to me. I restricted the pores in my palms to keep my hands from sweating as I took it. Not that I wasn't used to stealing, far from it. This might be more petty than the jobs I used to do, but I'd helped my parents steal many, many times the amount Angel was handing me from people who had earned their money a lot more honestly. If anything, robbing drug dealers made me feel slightly better about myself. Today, though, all of this felt a whole lot dirtier, and not just because the floor in Tommy's shop was in desperate need of mopping. This time, the cash wasn't the only thing I was here for. I took the cash drop and shoved it in my deep pockets, causing my pants to slide another inch down my hips.
Did Julian drop off the tabs yet? I asked.
Angel shrugged.
Not while I've been here.
I raised an eyebrow and gave Angel my best intimidating glare.
You gonna check?
Angel rolled his eyes, muttered something about not getting paid well enough to deal with me, and then ambled toward the back room to the other safe. And I was glad, because while Tommy might be fully capable of opening his own damn safe to see if his drugs were there, my profiling hadn't netted me the combination. I followed Angel into the back room and watched as he opened it. He stood between me and the dial, but it didn't matter. I didn't need the numbers. I only needed Angel to enter them for me. He shoved aside some papers in the safe and pulled out a large Ziploc full of smaller, unmarked baggies.
Yep,
Angel said.
There you go. Give it here,
I said.
I've got a delivery to make.
Angel shrugged and tossed the bag at me, then wandered back up to the front of the store, muttering something under his breath about how I could have gotten them myself. I stared at the bag in my hand. I might have committed more felonies than all my years of life combined, but possession of this much Vicodin had never been one of them. I could have taken all the pills. There had to be hundreds of them. But I didn't want to believe that I needed that many. Just a few. Two bags worth ought to be enough. I reached in and pulled out the baggies and shoved them into my pocket with the cash drop. I thought about conveniently losing the rest, but that, too, counted as getting extracurricular. So instead, I tossed the Ziploc back in the safe and slammed the thing shut. On my way out of the store, I gave one last disdainful look at Angel to let him know I found him wanting. Then I barked,
later,
and wandered back to where Tommy's truck was waiting. I had to force myself not to jitter as I pulled the truck out of the parking lot, holding my knees still to keep them from bouncing up and down, up and down. On the other side of the block, I parked next to a laundromat. I pulled jeans and a t-shirt in a girl's size from one of the unattended dryers, then tossed 2 20s from the cash drop in with the remaining clothes. The ones I'd taken didn't look expensive. Hopefully, that would more than cover them. I ducked into the bathroom to get changed. I reduced my body, sucking in all of Tommy's bulky mass into a wiry girl a few years younger, and several pounds smaller than my normal self. I pushed several feet of jet black hair out of my bald scalp, then dulled it a bit. Shiny hair attracted attention. When I got the pants on, I had to lengthen my legs so they wouldn't drag, since I'd undershot a bit. I stuffed the bags of pills into the pouch of money and tucked the whole mess into the front of my pants, then sucked in my waist a bit to compensate so it wouldn't be visible while I walked home. When I walked out of the bathroom, I stuck Tommy's clothes in a dryer, inserted a few coins, and let it run. I left the laundromat, abandoning Tommy's truck on the curb. Tommy would find it eventually. He'd go by the store and find that Angel didn't have the drop. Angel would tell Tommy he'd already been there. Tommy would know that he hadn't. That was messy, but it wasn't like they'd want to draw legal attention to their operation. Tommy would probably fire Angel for being a liar and a thief, and Angel would probably think Tommy set him up to be fired for one reason or another. In the worst case scenario, one of them might shoot the other,
and the world would be down a drug dealer. Whatever happened, it wouldn't fall back on me or my mother. No one would suspect shifters were involved, mostly because they didn't know we existed. On my way back to our apartment, I passed through an underground parking garage. In a corner, away from cameras, I reshaped my face into the persona I'd been using at our apartment complex, a gaunt girl with thin limbs that made her look frail and unassuming. I tightened my hair into a short bob that made my features appear more severe than they were. I walked the remaining block to our apartment complex the long way around, brushing the cash drop in my pants. I paused when I saw our new neighbor hovering by her window. She hobbled along with a walker, but she still managed to open her door just as I stepped onto our doormat, keys in hand.
"Amelia," she said.
I forced a smile at her, one I knew looked natural. I called myself Amelia when I introduced myself to her when she'd moved in about a week ago. Before that, all our neighbors had been the kind who kept to themselves. I felt bad for trying to avoid her. She was a lonely old woman, after all. But she would keep me standing on the doorstep for hours if I let her.
"Hi, Laura," I said. "How's the knitting?"
Through the window, I could see every surface of Laura's living room covered in afghans and doilies and skein after skein of yarn. It was no wonder she never invited me in. There was barely room for Laura to sit herself. Which hadn't stopped me from breaking into her house to watch her sleep the night after she moved in. New people made me nervous. New people with limps made me want to run. But Laura looked like herself in her sleep, and everything inside the apartment checked out. There were at least 4 shifters who would be looking for me and my mother, but she wasn't any of them. Shifters can look like anyone, but we can't hold on to other personas once we fall asleep.
"Not knitting," Laura said. "Crochet. I finished another blanket. I thought I might make one for your mother next. How is she?"
I tried not to twitch.
"I'm not sure," I said. "Have you seen her today?"
"No," Laura said. "That's why I'm asking. Is she still ill? I hope it doesn't have anything to do with her face. She looked like she was healing so well."
I cringed. If I wished one thing, it was that Laura's windows didn't face our door. It wasn't healthy to have someone watching us all the time. Someone who might remember details about the cuts on Mom's face.
"I'd better go check on her," I said.
I took the out, shoving the door open and slipping inside before Laura could protest.
"I'll see you later, dear,"
she shouted as I closed the door. I locked it behind me. If Laura got any pushier, Mom and I would need to move. Safely inside, I checked to make sure the curtains were closed. They always were. Mom rarely saw it the light of day anymore, but it paid to be careful. Then I relaxed into my homebody, the one formed by my subconscious when I wasn't intentionally forming myself into someone else. When my dad was alive, we always used our home faces with our neighbors. Safer that way, since we reverted to them in our sleep. But now that people were hunting us, Mom said we could only use them inside, where no prying eyes might see. She was recognizable enough as it was, what with the scars on her face. Even in here, I felt exposed. I walked through the near-empty living room and kitchen. Usually, when we moved to a new place, we decorated right away, so we wouldn't look as transient as we were. But not here. Mom didn't seem to care that our empty rooms looked suspicious. This time, she'd only bought 2 beds and a folding chair. We couldn't even sit down together. I wondered if, for her, refusing to turn this apartment into a home made it hurt less to have Dad gone. For me, it served as a constant reminder that nothing would ever be the way it was again. On my way to the kitchen, I pulled out the cash drop and tossed it under the kitchen counter, then pulled out the baggies of pills. I had the ridiculous urge to flush them. I'd actually tried that a month ago, the first time Mom came home with pain pills instead of the sleeping pills she'd stolen right after Dad died. I understood that she wasn't sleeping. Hell, my own nightmares were enough to make me never want to sleep again. But the pain Mom was in wasn't the kind that got fixed with a pill. I'd flushed the whole bottle, and before I knew it, she'd disappeared to get more. I shoved the pills back in my pocket and knocked on the door to Mom's room, shoving aside a pile of laundry that had made its way outside the door.
"I'm up,"
she called, though from the scratchiness of her voice, I knew that she hadn't been. I pushed the door open. Mom sat up in bed, rubbing her eyes. The nightstand was littered with prescription bottles. Whether Mom had forged or stolen those prescriptions, I couldn't tell. I supposed it didn't really matter. Regardless, she was still leaving the apartment, putting herself at unnecessary risk. She needed to stop taking the drugs, but more than that, she had to stay safe. I had to keep her safe, at least until she'd had enough time to recover from our loss. I stepped into the room and Mom stopped rubbing her face long enough to take my hand. Her scars were an angry pink color in the dim fluorescent light. We gave our hand signal, taking turns shifting our palms and responding, our secret code that allowed us to recognize each other. But then she drew her hand away and ran it through the tangles of her hair, shifting them straight. I hesitated, the pills still buried in my pocket. Mom didn't need more drugs. She needed a miracle. The cuts on her face were healing well, but even with plastic surgery, the scars would never disappear entirely. Even the best laser treatments probably wouldn't get rid of the scar tissue completely, and any imperfection on her face would be emphasized when she tried to shift her skin tone. Scars might hurt another person's vanity, but they threaten Mom's whole life. Even wearing makeup wouldn't do the trick, because if she got herself into a pinch, the makeup wouldn't shift with her. We couldn't even get her proper medical treatment to help her partially heal. The Carmines were hunting us, and they were ruthless and powerful. Doctors kept good records. One note on a computer with internet access that accurately described her scars, and the Carmines could search us out, even if we had it done in another part of the world. That's why they'd given her this particular injury, after all. Scars were precise and specific, and therefore easy to trace. Moreover, they'd know exactly where to find Mom unconscious if they found out the date of her surgery. Then she might be kidnapped, tortured, even killed. I had to prevent that, even if it meant running jobs like the one I'd just done. I hovered near Mom's bed, still not wanting to hand her the pills, even though I'd gone to so much trouble to get them. "Are you feeling okay?" I asked. "I'm fine," Mom said. "Just a little tired. I think I'm coming down with something." It took all my training to nod sympathetically. I wanted to shake her. She was coming down, all right, but not the kind that was caused by a virus. My stomach hurt. I never felt Dad's absence more than when I was with Mom, and I couldn't help but hate it. This wasn't how things were supposed to be. Dad would have known what to do, besides steal her the pills she insisted on risking her life for. But Dad wasn't here, and I was doing the best I could. "Okay," I said. "Maybe tomorrow you'll feel better." I took a deep breath and pulled the pills out of my pocket. "You probably don't need them, but I brought you these." Mom's eyes fixed on the pills. "Thanks," she said. She snatched them from me and headed into the bathroom. Thanks. In another life, my mother would have been horrified that I'd been in a position to steal drugs. But today, she didn't even blink. I tried to relax, but couldn't. I just stared at the cracked bathroom door, listening as Mom washed her face. I shifted my body, preventing it from shrinking like a child. Home used to be the place where I didn't have to use my acting skills, not the place where I needed them the most. Through the opening in the bathroom door, I could see Mom opening the bags, pouring a few pills into her hand, turning them over and examining them. I couldn't watch her swallow them. Instead, I went into the kitchen, ripped the money pouch open, and counted out enough for rent, plus extra for groceries. There was still quite a bit left. I walked down to the rent drop and deposited the cash. I went to the store and bought a cereal and milk. And on the way home, I dropped by the gym and opened my rented locker. Stashed at the back were several disposable cell phones. I reached for a specific one, my stomach twisting, and used it to check an old email account. And there, right where I expected it to be, was a message from Wendy Carmine. The woman who, as far as I was concerned, might as well be the devil herself. "Jory," it said, "I hope you're considering my offer. We can work with you and your mother. We don't have to be enemies. Bring us Mel, or information that leads to his capture, and we'll consider you both part of our team." The email was just as polite as the others I'd received, but no less galling. The first message came about 6 weeks ago through an email address I used to use when my parents and I worked with Mel and Aida. two shifters who ran a theft and espionage ring out of San Jose. That was before Mel framed my parents for his own murders and turned us into the Carmines, who tried to have them killed for their crimes. Aida called it justice, but even if my parents had committed the murders, it would have been vigilante justice at best. I should have abandoned all my former email addresses, but I was always watching for communication from Khalif, my boyfriend, who also had the misfortune of being Mel and Aida's son. And, okay, maybe I'd gotten a little desperate to hear from him and was checking every contact he might use, just in case. I wouldn't give away our location just by checking that email. The Carmines wouldn't know if I'd even received it. But Wendy was persistent. She'd sent one per week, each one pleading with me to bring them the man who turned in my father for his own murders. Too bad they didn't figure out my father was innocent before they shot him. The Carmines kidnapped my parents. They killed my dad. They cut on my mother's face. There was no way in hell I was going to work for them. But still, I checked the emails. They itched at me, like the bite of a persistent mosquito, one that carried a deadly, untreatable disease. I couldn't help but feel like I could use this offer against them to somehow get them off my mother's trail for good. It felt like our best chance, maybe our only chance. If only I could figure out how. 2. I was most of the way home when one of my disposable phones vibrated on my hip. I smiled. I had a lot of burner phones. I marked them for each job and tossed them as quickly as possible to avoid leaving a trail. But this one was special. This was the phone with the number I'd emailed Khalif at his alternate email address, the only way I was allowed to contact him. He never checked it from home or on any device that he carried home with him. And I didn't contact him any more than necessary, which, lately, hadn't been at all. I put the phone to my ear. "Hello?" I said.
"Seizure ninjas," Khalif said.
I smiled. In person, we used hand codes to verify each other's identities. A necessity when your boyfriend can shift himself to look like literally anyone. One of the first things we'd done when we were separated was work out a series of codes that we could use to be sure we were actually talking to each other. We could only use each one once, in case we were overheard, so the list was long and obtuse, but we'd both memorized it and then destroyed it. Good thing we both had good memories. A professional skill. "Illegal teenage driving," I said back.
"Hey," Khalif said. "I was really hoping I'd get to hear your voice today."
I kept my voice calm, even though my pulse quickened. "Miss me?"
"Like crazy. But I promise I'm not wasting your phone without a reason."
I wouldn't have minded if he did. Just hearing his voice on the other end was enough reason for me. But this was part of the arrangement. My mom would never trust him. She'd come unglued if she knew I'd given him any way to find us. The less contact we had, the less likely we were to get caught. But being away from him still made me miserable. I bounced on my toes. "Tell me you have good news." Khalif's voice dropped.
"No, you're not going to like this."
Oh. I leaned against the outside wall of the apartment. "Hit me." Khalif sounded strained, like he really didn't want to say this.
"My mom wants to talk to you."
I blinked. His mother had lied to my family, set up my parents to die, and tried to cover it up and keep me in the dark. After Mel and the Carmines, she was the last person on Earth that I wanted to talk to. Come to think of it, Khalif's entire family pretty much filled out that list.
"What?"
I said. Khalif drew a deep breath.
"I know. I swear I didn't tell her we'd been in contact. In fact, I told her I couldn't help her because I didn't know how to reach you."
Good on him. But she didn't believe you.
No. She told me not to treat her like she was stupid.
If Aida knew Khalif knew how to find me, that made it doubly important that we cover our tracks. Did she know that the Carmines were trying to get in touch with me? If she did, she could have emailed me directly. Unless she was trying to get at me separately so they could pull a two-man con. I wasn't going to fall for that crap. You can't lead her to me, because you don't know where I am, right? Silence met me on the other end. I sighed. Of course he did. It was against Khalif's nature not to look. "Does your mother know where I am?"
"No,"
he said.
"At least, I don't think so."
He didn't sound as sure as I wanted him to.
"If she did, She could just find you to talk to you, instead of trying to set something up through me.
That was a fair point. Do you know what she wants?
No idea.
I squeezed my eyes shut. If Aida found us, she might turn my mom and me right over to her parents again. And even if she didn't, she was still working with them. They might be able to follow her to get to us. I cleared my throat.
If you want her off your back, you should turn it around on her. Tell her it's her fault that you'll never talk to me again, and she should quit rubbing it in.
Khalif sounded regretful.
Yeah, I did, but she still didn't believe me.
I was quiet for a minute.
You don't actually want me to talk to her, do you? She's probably trying to lead your grandparents right to me.
Khalif hesitated.
What?
I asked. It's just... She's told me a couple of times that if I'm not careful when I contact you, my grandparents will find you and it'll be my fault. Not like a threat, more like a warning.
I paused. That could be just a ploy to get Khalif to admit that he was in contact with me. But if that was Aida's plan, it didn't make a great deal of sense to suggest he should be more careful.
She'd want him to make a mistake.
What's her game? I asked.
I don't know, Khalif said.
But every time she mentions you, she's careful about it. She never says anything at home. She made sure we've changed clothes and are in a loud public place.
I could read between the lines. Your apartment is bugged,
and your clothes, and your car. Probably,
Khalif said.
I don't use the internet connection there for anything I don't want them to see, and I only call you when I'm out and changed into clothes that have never been in the house.
Okay, I said. I remembered the horror on Aida's face when she thought that her parents might get a hold of Khalif. For nearly 17 years, she hadn't told them that she had a son. That's how scared of them she was. Now both she and Khalif were living under their thumb, in a place where their every move was being watched. And the longer I took getting Mom back on her feet, the longer Khalif stayed there, the more likely his grandparents were to pull him into their world. A place where they were so afraid of being exposed as shifters that they kill or threaten every shifter who wouldn't work directly for them. I didn't know if I was more afraid of what they might do to him, or what they might ask him to do. Cooperating with Aida might be safer for him than fighting against her. If I called her on a disposable, would she be able to trace my location?
Khalif sounded surprised I was even considering it. The best she could do is get the cell tower you're using, especially if I'm with her. She won't be able to start a trace without me knowing. And if you called from someplace far from home, she'd only be able to pinpoint the area of the country you're in.
He paused.
Do you want to do this?
No, I said. I don't like her knowing we're in contact, and I don't love the idea of her being able to tell so much as what country I'm in.
Especially since you're still in the Bay Area.
I sighed. Okay, for real. How did you find me? Khalif sounded embarrassed.
I tracked your emails to the San Mateo Public Library, Hillsdale branch.
My cheeks burned. Of course he would. I should have known. Better yet, I should have masked the location somehow, the way Khalif always did. But I didn't know how to do that on a home computer, much less on a public one. Tech stuff was his half of the job. Khalif cleared his throat nervously.
Was I not supposed to do that?
I rolled my eyes. This was Khalif. He could no more keep himself from doing things like that than he could keep himself from breathing. No, it's fine. Let's just pretend I thought of that. Do you think she knows, then?
Doubtful. I don't access that email from home, and I do cover my tracks.
I tried not to take that as a jab. If there was one thing I could trust Khalif to do, it was to handle his electronic footprint.
I was much better at the in-person stuff.
I'd feel a lot safer when we could both watch each other's backs again. And as much as I hated to admit it, whatever Aida had to say might bring us closer to being together again, more so than anything I'd been doing. I hated that I felt so alone I was willing to look to Aida for an out. Don't give her too much notice. None, if possible.
Okay,
Khalif said.
Don't stick at home, though. If she manages to trace the call, you don't want to let her know where you're living.
I couldn't call from home for other reasons. There was no way I could let Mom overhear this. Am I being stupid? I asked. Maybe you could just find out what she wants.
I tried,
Khalif said.
As much as I could without admitting I'd been in contact with you.
She told me she only wants to talk to you. That was suspicious, wasn't it? Unless she wanted to send me a message she thought Khalif wouldn't want to pass on. If that was...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?